Welcome back, everybody. Thank you very much for keeping the lunch under 45 minutes. So now we're going to test your arousal systems. Our first speaker today is James Kennedy from University of Toronto and CAMH. Dr. Kennedy has done a tremendous amount of really very seminal work on the genetics of, especially of dopamine systems, which are extremely relevant for the problems that we're discussing today. He is the director of neuroscience research, the head of the neurogenetics section at CAMH, and the head of the neuroscience program in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Toronto. And he also, like many people, was heroic in coming back here. He apparently was in England yesterday doing a panel, flew back to Toronto, and flew here this morning. So we're very appreciative again of your attendance.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And today I'm going to try to help you make your way through a lot of the recent findings in genetics of body mass index and obesity. And in reply to the question just before the lunch break, the question was about drug-induced weight gain. And I'm going to show you some very recent interesting data using drug-induced weight gain as a model to study obesity. So that question was a very nice segue. And regarding England, yesterday the MRC panel that I was on for neuroscience had a strategy meeting. And one of their areas of emphasis going forward for the next 3 years is going to be the neuroscience of obesity. So if you are from England and you want funding from the Medical Research Council of the UK, I can tell you that your opportunities will increase. And yesterday we gave away £20 million in research funding for neuroscience in general. So a chunk of that will go to neuroscience and obesity. Turning to genetics, there's when one tries to find genes involved in weight gain and obesity, you're faced with two kinds of enormous complexity. The first kind, roughly pictured here, is the complexity of the phenotype. That is, how do we measure obesity, and how do we control for all the things that go along with obesity that might be predisposing to weight gain or might be a result of the weight gain. And here I've chosen to emphasize psychiatric conditions, since I'm a psychiatrist. Suzanne mentioned in her talk before the break about rimonabant, and the rimonabant was pulled off the market because it caused depression. People lost their interest in food, but they also lost their interest in life. And suicidal ideation increased. So that's through the cannabinoid receptor. And so there's links to depression. I'm going to tell you about the food addiction model a little bit later. In Toronto with Robert Levitan and Caroline Davis, we've been studying binge eating disorder. And as well, I've done a lot of work on genetics of attention deficit hyperactivity, which relates to impulsivity, which relates to how well you can stop yourself from grabbing the chocolate brownie for dessert when you really shouldn't have it. And so I'll try to pull this together by the end of the talk. I'm going to give you samplings of some of the major thrusts in genetics of obesity. So there's the behavioral complexity, then there's the chemical and neuroanatomical complexity that you've heard lots about, and the reason for this slide is just to give you a gestalt of the complexity, which you've been well apprised of by now. But our approach in studying the genetics of eating behavior and drug-induced obesity is to try and use the neuroscience to tell us which genes to look at. And so one of our best candidates is the dopamine system, which is involved in reward, and you've heard something about that from Suzanne before lunch. And I'm going to give you an example of a couple of dopamine genes that we think might be involved in overeating. And part of the original title of my talk included epigenetics, and there's really only one main thing to tell you, and that is that the technology does now exist to go across the entire human genome to look for epigenetic changes, but it has not been applied to any kind of large-scale human studies yet. A major limitation, a methodologic challenge is a better phrase, for epigenetics is the fact that it's tissue-specific. And so if we want to study the brain and obesity, we need brain tissue to see the modifications of the DNA in the brain tissue. And this is one kind of epigenetic mechanism where the folding of the histones causes the DNA to be scrunched up and therefore inaccessible by the transcription factors that regulate the genes that turn them on and off. But when the histones have their acetyl groups altered, the scrunched up DNA opens up and it opens its arms to the effect of these regulators, these on signals and off signals of gene expression. And the other characteristic of epigenetics is that it can change over a person's lifetime. And here in Montreal, Professor Michael Meany has shown how the mothering behavior of rats can change the modification of the DNA, the methylation patterns of the stress hormone receptors in the rat pups. And this influences their stress response as they grow up. So this is a very promising area for complex diseases. My former postdoc, Arturos Petronis, has a nice review in Nature last June if you want to learn more about epigenetics and complex disease. I'll come back to epigenetics very briefly later. So why do we study the genetics of obesity when we've got all this complexity of the behavior, we've got the complexity of the biochemistry, and we've got the complexity of the human genome? It's a very big challenge indeed, but a lot of resources have been marshaled to try and find genetic factors in obesity, mostly because of this one point right here, and that is in very rigorous methodology in twin studies where you compare identical twins versus fraternal twins, So identical DNA versus siblings who share half of their DNA, you can come up with very powerful mathematical proof about how much genes are involved in a particular phenotype. And in a couple of decades of twin studies of weight regulation and weight gain and obesity and diabetes and many other related phenotypes, there's 40 to 70% of the variation in this case, body mass index, is determined by genetic factors. So that's a lot of variance, a lot of risk accounted for by genetics. And you'll see as I progress in my slides that this gets very complicated because the very large study that I'm going to walk you through to give you the end result early, it found many genes but a very tiny effects. And so people are now asking the question, where is the missing heritability? And that is the study that I'll show you on 250,000 people, the largest genetic study ever conducted, this is molecular genetic, could only account for, at best, 7% of the variance in risk for obesity. And the twin studies are showing us that, you know, at least half of the variance is due to genetic factors. So where are the missing genes? My answer to that is I don't know, but some of the great minds in genetics are thinking about that, and I will give you a few suggestions as we go on. So for those of you who are not familiar with genetics, the big revolution in technology and genetics was the use of DNA chips, where on these little chips, we can using kind of a laser printing process, we can put now 1 million genetic tests on one chip. And so we take a spot of blood from a person, extract the DNA, and put it on this chip, and this chip will sample or interrogate, we say, 1 million different genetic variants. So this is a very powerful technology, it's very important today for me to walk you through this big study and then a smaller study of this genome-wide association study because there's a lot of writing in the literature about these kind of studies. The most recent and large study of body mass index was by this very large group, first author Speliotis et al. And they did a two-stage scan of all the chromosomes, all the DNA in each person for in stage one, about 125,000 people, and then in stage two, about another 125,000 people. And what they did is they took the best results from the first 125,000 people and tested them in the second group. So this is a massive study. Basically, each one of these chips and with the phenotype costs the researcher $1,000. So if you multiply 125,000 by 1,000, you got $125 million. So each of these two studies, well, the two together, cost $250 million. So this is very high tech and high expense, high information research. And so the first $125 million found 42 markers. I don't know, I'm not sure how many million that is per marker, but 42 markers, about 3 million each, I guess, with these p-values better than 10 to the minus 6. And then in stage 2, these 42 best results were checked in the next set of people with the body mass index measure. And one of the problems is on this slide, when you get to numbers this large, the heterogeneity of the phenotype becomes, it's at least linearly correlated with the number of people that you include in your study. And you've got all these different kinds of populations that, subtypes of Europe, people in the Mediterranean have been exposed to different food sources over the last 10,000 years than people in Northern Europe. And this has created some differences that, however small, show up in these very large studies. And there are many other kinds of heterogeneity. So here are the results. So here you see the p-value over here. Sorry for the small font, but it's the p-value 10 to the minus 120 for the FTO gene. The FTO gene is, fat and obesity gene. They're not really sure yet what it does, but it operates in the brain and in the rest of the body. And then the melanocortin 4 receptor was the next best. And then brain, underlying brain, derived neurotrophic factor was the third best. And the conclusion of the authors, perhaps justifying the funding, was that, this word robust is a nice word to use, right? And so they said that, well, we have robustly increased the number of genes involved in body mass index from 10 that were replicated previously to 32. They found a lot of genes that have a small effect, and by small effect here we have the explained variance here. So this is 0.34% of the variance in risk for increased body mass index for the FTO gene. MC4R, 0.1%, and brain-derived neurotrophic factor, 0.07% of the variance. And when you have these enormous numbers of subjects, of course, you can find these very small effects. In the general interpretation of these kind of genome-wide studies, is, yes, the effects are small, but these are like little pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. And if we can figure out how the FTO gene and the melanocortin 4 and brain-derived neurotrophic factor fit together, then we can assemble this larger picture, which synergistically, we'll be able to identify the systems in the body that cause obesity. And already, without having any hypothesis in this direction, these genome-wide studies are agnostic, right? They don't have any hypothesis. We know that the brain-derived neurotrophic factor and MC4R have a very important inter-signaling effect in the brain. So already you can see these gene systems emerging from the data. This slide has a lot of genes on it, but just note the gene names in red here. These were the new genes that were identified as you go across the chromosomes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and over here on chromosome 18, in blue is MC4R, which had already been identified in previous studies. Here's BDNF, already identified in previous studies. So this 250,000 people studied for genetics of BMI led to the discovery of these red-colored markers, some of which are important in the brain, some of which are, this is a Z and F, zinc finger motif is a transcription factor, and so a lot of new genes of small effect. And here's two ways of showing you how all these discovered genes add together. On this side, across the bottom is the number of risk alleles across these different genes in this sample. And you can see if you have 38 or greater of these risk factors, these risk genes, your BMI is increased to 28.5 on average. But most people, you see this sort of Gaussian distribution, most people have, say, between 25 and 30 of the risk alleles. But the people who have less than 20 of these risk factors, they have a lower BMI below 26. And over here is a rather complicated curve where the diagonal straight line is the 50% chance prediction effect, and this dotted line is the effect of all these markers added together. And the area under the dotted line curve is 7% prediction. So it's 57% prediction when you look at sensitivity and specificity. Coming to the end of this story, I wanted to make a point about heterogeneity. It's portrayed in this graph. These are two studies, two samples from Rotterdam in Holland, and you can see that the green line study had quite a bit of increased prediction of variance. It's on the y-axis here, as opposed to the other Rotterdam study that only had about 0.5 percent of the variance predicted. So already you can see, as I was saying, that even within the same country in Holland, you can get populations that are different. You know, it depends on your sampling. And over here they made a prediction. Here's the sample size of the first discovery sample in this Spelliotti's paper. And in order to get, so they had, they could predict perhaps 1.5 percent of the variance. In order to get up to 4.5%, they need 730,000 people. So that's not very practical for research funding, I think. Coming back to the brain, so that's the big study of genetics of obesity, and that's the study that's going to be cited for a while. But that study and the study before it by Willer et al. Very much highlight the topic of interest to us today. That is the brain, and in particular, genes that are operative in the hypothalamus. So it means that the topic of this, of today's conference is even though the genetics were agnostic, they lit up the brain in terms of what's important in obesity. And so we're talking about the right topic today. There's many limitations to these studies. One other one that I mentioned in addition to heterogeneity that I wanted to mention was that the cross-sectional nature. So they just take a snapshot of the person. It's a very lightweight phenotype, very superficial. And you can imagine, you know, depending on where that person is in their stress levels and so on, their weight's going up and down, and there's a lot of noise in the phenotype. And body mass index has its own set of problems that you're probably familiar with, but visually here you can see these two people have the same body mass index. But this guy, you know, might be a Canadian speed skater. He's got, you know, big thighs full of muscle. And here's a person with the same BMI, but they're chubby. And so we need better measures of weight, you know, the ideal being total body MRI of adipose tissue, but that's not practical for any large studies. So coming back to the question, where's the missing heritability? One of the factors might be epigenetics, which I'm only mentioning to you today, But interestingly, the BDNF gene is definitely altered by epigenetic processes. The regulatory sites that control BDNF get differential coding by methyl groups, which changes the gene expression of BDNF. And those epigenetic methyl groups can be altered by environmental effects. And so the question hanging right now in the genetics of obesity is, will those little pieces of the jigsaw puzzle be able to be put together in some kind of algorithm to predict risk for obesity? And thus, maybe we can intervene for those people who are at very high risk. And so in the last few slides, I just wanted to mention some of our work that we're doing in Toronto and a little bit setting up the next talk. We've done a lot of work on dopamine and eating behavior, and Caroline Davis, who's going to be participating tomorrow along with Dr. Levitan in a workshop that's being held tomorrow, she has developed this idea of food addiction and the idea of decision-making deficits and also reward sensitivity leading to weight gain and difficulty controlling the way you eat. And through a great deal of work in addictions, this circuit is emerging where you've got this sort of driving force from the accumbens that you heard a bit about before lunch, this motivational system is pushing up out of the more primitive parts of our brain, and you may or may not have a successful prefrontal cortex control of those impulses to grab the chocolate brownie. And if you do it again and again and do this loop that involves dopamine and opioid systems, apparently this lower part of the striatum activity then gets consolidated by the dorsal part of the striatum, starts to cement the behavior and create the compulsivity that you want that brownie again and again. And so that's the kind of circuitry that we're trying to dissect from a genetic point of view. And so turning to this interesting but kind of fuzzy concept of impulsivity and how well your prefrontal cortex can stop you from doing something, I wanted to give you an example of how research is done of this, and this is one example from our study based here in Montreal, led by Dr. Michael Meany, where we're studying development of children from birth, and so this they're getting this stop signal reaction time, which they watch a computer screen, see ducks walking across, and they press the computer button every time a duck walks across the screen. But then if a tone sounds, they have to stop themselves from pressing the computer button. So it's their ability to stop something that they get in the habit of doing. And so in a very preliminary study of this presumably prefrontal type activity, our Mayban group has found that if you co-vary for birth weight, so the kids are divided into low birth weight versus normal birth weight, so the white columns here are kids that are low birth weight, and then if you factor in the dopamine D1 genetic variants displayed here as you can have a G or an A nucleotide in a regulatory part of the dopamine D1 gene, you can see that kids with the G allele have a longer decision-making time, a longer reaction time to when the tone sounds. So this very preliminary study has got us interested in this the dopamine and prefrontal effect on being able to suppress a habitual behavior. And so finally, in answer to the question before lunch, I just wanted to tell you about this very nasty effect that antipsychotic drugs have of causing weight gain. If you look at the left-hand side here, here's 4-point-something kilograms of weight gained after only, say, 8 weeks of treatment with the drug clozapine. Olanzapine is also causing a lot of weight gain, and you can see almost all of the antipsychotic drugs cause serious weight gain. So we've been studying this in my lab in Toronto for a number of years, and because all the antipsychotics have in common, they bind to the dopamine D2 receptor, we used our genetic tools to dissect the D2 receptor gene. And focusing in on this marker right here, C957T, so in your dopamine D2 gene, you can have a C or a T at position 957. And this variant has been shown to predict the activity of dopamine in human imaging studies and also in the test tube in cell studies of D2 function. So taking that marker, for example, in our sample of clozapine-induced weight gain, the people with the two copies of the C variant gained almost 6 kilograms during treatment with the drug clozapine, whereas people who had the T variant gained 2 to 3 kilos. So this could be the beginnings of a specific dopamine factor in antipsychotic-induced weight gain. And here's a very recent result that we have submitted, but hasn't been published yet. And this is a genome-wide study with the chips that I told you about before. But here, given our frugal Canadian budget, sorry, Tony, the CIHR, you know, has trouble paying for 250,000 people. But, you know, being good Canadians, we did the best we could, and we were as smart as we could be, and we took the extreme phenotype. So the worst case of drug-induced weight gain is in children. And this is a group of kids that ages 7 to 16 that were treated with these kind of nasty antipsychotic drugs because they had nasty behavior. They did not have schizophrenia. They had very disruptive behavior, violent behavior, severe ADHD, and so on. And virtually all of these kids, aged 7 to 16 years, gained weight when they took these antipsychotic drugs. So in the sample size of only 180 people compared to the 250,000 that I told you about before, we did a genome-wide study on those 180 kids with this very extreme weight gain. And in what geneticists call a Manhattan plot, it's kind of resembling the buildings in Manhattan, we got one very nice peak on chromosome 18. And this is where the GWAS strategy can work very well. And it emphasizes my point that in that big quarter million people, you've got a really mixed phenotype. Here, you've got kids treated with a drug that's provoking their system, and so you get a nice sharp signal on one chromosome 18q. And so you may wonder what gene is under that peak on 18q. Well, first we have to take you from New York to Toronto, because this was not a Manhattan plot, this was a Toronto plot. And this very, very sharp peak, which went up 553 meters into the sky above 10 to the minus 7, was at the melanocortin 4 receptor gene. So we rediscovered MC4R with this hypothesis-free genome-wide study. But good geneticists don't take one study before they start saying much about it. So we replicated this study from the kids over here. So here's the best marker, and here in red is the, if you've got two copies of the A allele, you gained 9 kilograms of weight after about 8 weeks of treatment with antipsychotics. That was in the genome-wide study. Then we looked at my adult sample of clozapine-treated schizophrenia patients in Toronto. Same pattern, AA genotype, the most weight gain. Then in a third sample, it was Dr. Mueller collected in Germany, which we're studying in Toronto. Same pattern, AA genotype, big weight gain. So this is a nicely replicating result in this very specific model for antipsychotic-induced weight gain. So that's the whirlwind tour of genetics of obesity. And to try and pull this together, basically, I've told you that there's many small effect genes, and biologists and geneticists are trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together. And you know, it's still early, so give us a bit of time to do that. And when you go to a more specific phenotype, as opposed to just body mass index, which I showed you the problems with, you can get some very nice results, as we did with the antipsychotic drug-induced weight gain in kids. And this, I think we're going to discuss more as the afternoon goes on about this dopamine and addiction model of eating behavior. And coming to this last result on melanocortin 4, maybe putting all this together and to try and provoke you into thinking for action, maybe if we could really help people, if we could come up with a melanocortin 4 agonist, so we have to rev up the MC4R receptor, and from our addiction and impulsivity work, we need to train the frontal cortex to be able to put the brakes on this impulsive behavior. And so an MC4 agonist and cognitive behavior therapy might be the answer for obesity. So I will stop there, and thank you very much for your attention.
We have time for a couple of questions. What about dopamine in the GWAS studies? Why no dopamine?
Good question. The dopamine genes did not light up at the kind of harsh statistical threshold that has to be imposed because of the half a million tests that are done with these chips. The dopamine genes tended to be in the 10 to the minus 3 range, which is above random, but not in the top signals. And it could be that, well, I would say that you want to get to more specific phenotypes where people are having behavioral problems leading to obesity, and that's where the dopamine genes might light up.
Thanks. Were there any genes that were sort of in the middle and made the 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 8 range where you were where you might see a better explanation of larger amount of variance rather than, let's say, extremely high correlation?
The extreme of that strategy is to take the top half of the distribution. So you take this was done recently in schizophrenia genetics. And when they took the top 50%, just as a kind of a modeling, the top half markers in the GWAS, it explained 30% of the variance in risk for schizophrenia. So, that was portrayed as an argument for many, many common genetic effects for a complex disease like schizophrenia. So far, we've not found the right way to combine the genes together. Because if there are multiplicative effects, where in order for gene B to be effect to be having an effect, it has to be multiplied by gene A, you won't see that in GWAS studies because the multiplier is not accounted for. You have to study those two genes together. So if we can figure out which two genes to look at, we do have the methods to check for the multiplier effect, the so-called epistasis. But we need to have an a priori reason because we can't handle the mathematics of any more than multiplying two genes at the same time.
You talked about heterogeneity. We get two perspectives of heterogeneity. One is a population perspective, like when we talk about the population, they have lifestyle, food habit, and everything while doing the association analysis. And then again, we have population substructure in terms of their genetic makeup. So what has to be dealt in priority while doing genome-wide association studies? And my next question is that you did genome-wide association. So prior to that, have you considered the structuring of the population? I mean, whether there is a substructuring in terms of their genetic architecture or not. So that's the issue.
Right, right. Very good question. And a whole other part of a talk, potentially. With this is another word for this is the structure of the population or the stratification, and one of the good things of using so many markers on a chip is that you can then just analyze your whole sample without any regard to the phenotype to see how the people in your study form clusters. So we can readily separate people of different continental ancestries with about 100 markers. And when you go to 500,000 or a million markers, you can resolve very small differences in geographical ancestry of people. One famous example was a study in central London of breast cancer patients from the hospitals in central London in the UK. They got their controls from East Anglia, which is, 30 to 50 kilometers east of London. And they found a difference. They found these genes that were different in the women from the downtown London group. But it was all because of population substructure, because when they looked at this measurement using it's like a principal components analysis, in fact, they could separate the East Anglia people from the central London people just because, they had systematic differences in their genetic makeup. So this is an example of what you're pointing to. In terms of your first question in the culture, what would be best, we need to control for culture because culture could affect epigenetics, which can then interact with genetics. So an ideal study would have people having the same cultural habits, same diet, same ways of eating. All Spanish people that all eat at midnight instead of people who eat at 6 p.m., that there's many things that should be controlled for culturally, and these big studies so far have not really controlled for cultural heterogeneity.
Sir, talking about that epigenetic part portion, since you have already talked, it's a new field, but still we have epigenetic variation in terms of tissue specification, in terms of individual, and then temporal variation we have. I really don't know what is the answer to deal simultaneously these three things together.
Right. It's going to be difficult, but I... one partial answer is this study that I mentioned based here in Montreal, the maternal adversity study. You're very right to mention this time dimension. And so we have these 500 kids that we're following. It's a Montreal, Toronto, Hamilton study. And we're going to follow these kids as they grow older and try to correlate the genetic factors with their stage of development. And that's beginning to get at this temporal dimension, which is very important. And we can study the epigenetics of their peripheral blood cells, the lymphocytes. And so we'll get some information about epigenetic changes over time in kids, at least in their blood cells.
Okay, one last quick question.
Very nice presentation. Just like to come back to your first part of the presentation, the GWAS study on the BMI. You refer to the missing heritability. As you know, there are different explanations for that. One of them is that there's no missing heritability, just because in a polygenic effect, the effect of those genes cannot be tracked in a GWAS study. They are just too small to explain the polygenic component. So I just want to have your thought of this.
Well, yes, it's one of the many theories. Another that I think was discussed yesterday was the each person has their own private set of more major gene effects, perhaps some of these bigger deletions. That's another theory about the missing heritability, and it is possible, and this big BMI study points in that direction, that there's all these little effects bouncing around in our genomes, and we may never be able to find a way to put them all together because the signals are so small.
Just like quickly to draw your attention, part of the answer to that is a paper that has been published by Yang et al. In Nature Genetics last year. They look at height, which is a highly heritable trait. If you look at the GWAS of height, there were like 50 loci explaining 5% of the variation. What they did is they type about 300,000 markers on 4,000 individuals, and they look at these markers to establish the relatedness between individuals, and they just made a regression on height. It's basically a classical quantitative genetic approach, and guess what? They explain about 50% of the variation in height. So I think that's a kind of data that support the fact that in GWAS we are missing a lot of variants that are probably too small, and those variants contribute to the polygenic effect of most traits that we are interested in.
Right. The height study was very informative.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.